harping on the wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind you switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking. Running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be worn. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm if you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you walking on the crack inside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fight inside of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and of course those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and I'm going to play the recording. This is the weekly program called The Ethnostate, this week with Chairman of the American Freedom Party, William Johnson, Ken Givedan, and myself, Paul Fromm. And this one's entitled, Still Honest About Race, Why Japan Isn't Hung Up About Race.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Ethnostate. This is your host and moderator, who goes by the name today of Bill Williams. Why? Because Ken sent around a notice to everyone, that's my name, Bill Williams. This is not the first time he made that mistake. And maybe I told you the story last time, but when I first got married, I was living in Japan. And if you look at my marriage certificate, I got married in Washington, D.C., it says William Johnson from Tokyo, Japan. And if any of my kids marry someone from Tokyo, then I'll be upset. But in any event, the gal I married got a job with the symphony in Tokyo. And she was playing with the symphony before we got married. And when we got married, they knew that her name had changed. And her name was Lois Watkins, and they knew my name was William Johnson. They didn't know which was our first name, which was our last name, which name changed. So the next concert that came out, her name was listed as William Watkins. And so they got both names wrong. So that kind of reminded me of what Ken just did. But in any event, we lived in Japan for the first couple of years of our marriage, and it was really fun. In fact, Paul, you were saying you wanted to go to Japan to study. What's up with that?
I'm I'm informed that they are less hung up about race as a question than most universities in North America and in Europe. And although my topic is it's not about anthropology, it is about the racial views of a very well-known American author who was not particularly preachy. It's not, you know, we're not talking about David Duke, but my fear is that any thesis that is anything other than a raging denunciation of views of the past, it would just be impossible. And I'm fairly well connected with people in universities in Canada, and the intellectual repression on campus is incredible.
So what would you do? You would apply to go to a school in Japan to get a PhD or a master's or what?
I have a master's, a PhD.
And what's the topic of your thesis?
The racial views of F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, the great author of The Great Gatsby.
Okay, now, F. Scott Fitzgerald, he was married to Zelda, right?
Yeah.
And he died, what, in the 1930s? I don't know.
He died in early in the 40s. I think he was only 44. He burned out, but he was just brilliant in his 20s.
And what were his racial views?
Well, that's interesting. That's what I want to explore. He put some very interesting racial views into the mouths of one of his characters in The Great Gatsby, and he refers to a book he attributes it to a man named Godard, but actually it was Lothrop Stoddard. Lothrop Stoddard was published by the same publishing company that published F. Scott Fitzgerald.
You mean, wait, you mean The Great Gatsby quotes Lothrop Stoddard?
Yep.
Oh, wow. Now, before we go on, was Gatsby, the character, was he Jewish?
No. He was a farm boy from the Midwest who made it, you know,
great.
Scrabbled his way up. Some of his associates were Jewish, but he was not.
All right. Well, that would actually be an interesting thesis, I think. So tell me what you want to do, and I'll use all of my connections, and we'll see if we can get you an audience with the emperor. How about that?
Okay.
Either that or get you enrolled in one of the universities there.
We've had an interesting development in Canada. We have a new political party. It's less than a year old. It's called the People's Party of Canada. It's led by a man from Quebec named Maxime Bernier, and it is a hardcore populist party, and they've really taken off. They're going to have candidates in almost every riding in Canada in the upcoming October 21st election, and he has taken a major stand on immigration, seriously reduced the numbers, cut them by more than 50%, insists that newcomers pass be culturally compatible. In other words, adopt Canadian values. No more of this, you know, people are secretly in favor of Sharia law, or they figure a man has the right to kill his daughter if she, does properly according to that. And so, he gets the law, at least one of the two major issues. And one of the major, what we're told is, but we need immigration to grow the economy. That is the party line. And he said, but no, and he's relying on research that actually we've published, a former professor of the University of British Columbia, Kurt Grubel, studied what the immigrants who come from the third world in the last 30 years, what they put into the tax form on all levels, the sales tax, income tax, etc., and then what they take out. What they take out every year is over $30 billion more than they put in. Immigration isn't growing the economy. Immigration is sucking the economy.
But, of course, it should not matter. Even if they all brought boatloads of cash into the economy, we don't want them. If they're not a Northern European, then we don't want them. That's where we should be.
We're all, you know, we're wanting to move in that direction. I absolutely agree. we have stopped the third world invasion. Is he there yet? Well, not quite there yet, but he says we have too much diversity. Diversity is destroying unity. Well, he's edging in that direction.
That's good.
Of course, all hell is broken loose. Some supporters bought billboards a couple weeks ago in about a dozen Canadian cities, and the immigration message was stop mass immigration. And a picture of the party leader and the party name. Well, all hell broke loose, and there was an online petition, and the company that owns the sign, Patterson Outdoor Advertising, they have almost a pretty close to monopoly. They own about 59% of the billboard space in Canada. They pulled the sign. However, it was a big controversy. A lot of people who might never have seen the billboards knew about them. So, and he's sticking to it. And that's, you know, that's very much to the good. And I was at a meeting where I was photographed with him, and he took all sorts of hell for that. They didn't call me a white nationalist, or white supremacist, meets with Maxime Bernier, and but he didn't disown me. You know, most other leaders would immediately have kicked me under the bus. So I expect interesting things
in America. The Federal Communications Commission controls broadcasting because the airwaves are considered to be the federal government. They can regulate that. But billboards are totally private. So in America, billboard companies routinely censor things that the TV and the broadcast media cannot censor. Is that the same way in Canada?
Yeah. Well, in elections, it would be difficult for a media company to censor an ad. It has been done, but
even a billboard media company, they can't censor.
No, it wouldn't apply to billboard companies.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they're free to. And the really provoking thing is that Patterson Advertising is owned by a gazillionaire in British Columbia named Jimmy Patterson, who got his start about 40 years ago as a used car salesman, and he did fantastically well. He has all sorts of car lots, and he's got his finger into all sorts of enterprises. If anybody could resist a little bit of a hissy fit from the far left, it would be he. But,
so, is he the Canadian Great Gatsby then?
I just don't think his life is very tragic. I mean,
okay. All right. Well, one last question before we move on. Is Maxine a man's name in French?
As a former Minister of Education in Ontario once said, I don't language too good. I didn't pronounce it very well. Maxime, like Maximilian. He's a man.
Oh, okay. It's not
Maxime,
like Aunt Maxine. Okay, got it. All right. Well, let's go on to some of the topics. We've got a lot of interesting topics today. So, Ken, the very first one on your list, I thought it was clever. You said Sanders panders. What's that all about?
This is about Bernie Sanders, who is doing what Democrats always do. He is pandering to the black vote. This comes from WashingtonTimes.com. Kind of interesting what it had to say. That is, let me get my mouse working here. Declaring the criminal justice system ruined by pervasive racism and corporate profiteering. Senator Bernie Sanders proposed a massive overhaul Sunday that would free many drug convicts. Abolish the death penalty. I can't read. And solitary confinement and promote an unarmed civilian corps to replace police in lower level calls. So effectively what he is doing is he is putting the blame on racism for the mass incarceration of black people.
Okay, so then he said, one, release prisoners, two, give the citizens the right to police their neighborhood, but don't give them, they don't have guns. And what was the third one?
The third one was he wanted to abolish the death penalty and solitary confinement.
Okay, got it. All right. Well, that's an interesting approach and a proposal. I always try to look to see what I can agree with. Okay, let's take the first part. Release scads and scads of prisoners. The Republicans, the conservatives, would put their hands on their hip and say, "No way, Juan. We can't let them out. We got to keep them in." And I'm thinking, what if we just let all the darn prisoners, just did away with our prison system, let everybody out? Then we'd be moving towards anarchy, which is what I want. So I kind of think that's not a bad idea. Let's just let everybody out. Let's do away with prisons. What do you think of that, Paul?
Well, I think they should be in halfway houses, so they're not as expensive. And those halfway houses could be strategic located very close to the residences of people like Bernie Sanders. Now, when you have a half-commanded person walking up and down the street, shooting up or raving at empty space at 10 in the morning, I have a feeling he might have a different point of view. It's a big grab bag of proposals. I mean, there may be something to the idea that people are incarcerated for nonviolent crimes, and maybe that's not the best approach. Certainly, the United States incarcerates far more people per capita than almost any other country than Red China. That may not be a good thing. I don't agree with abolishing the death penalty.
What if we call these prisoners and employ the death penalty? That'd have a better economic effect.
The thesis, though, is bullshit. That the criminal justice system is racist in both our countries. The reason there's a disproportionate number of blacks in prison is because they could commit a disproportionate amount of crime.
Isn't that racist? The fact is, the blacks are more violent, are more criminal. So the whole basis of that is involving race. So why reject that? Say, yeah, of course it's racist because the blacks commit more crimes. And to say that, to agree with that, that helps rehabilitate the term racism because it's applying it to a broader definition than we apply it to. I don't see what's wrong with saying our justice system is racist because indeed the blacks commit too many crimes and so they go to jail for it. And so I can agree with letting them out, but let's let them out and maybe send them like our ancestors did, send them to Australia, send them to Haiti. I'm kind of just being whimsical here. But the bottom line is that we do have too many prisoners, and everything that we're talking about now, that we're dancing around all of these major problems and trying to come up with stopgap prophylactic measures, like gun control. We got to have more gun control. We got to make our justice system less racial. The point is we've got an uncontrollable and uneducatable population that we sowed disharmony through multiculturalism and diversity. So I think we need to go to the root of it. And yes, our justice system is racist. The way to solve all this problem is have a white ethno state. Then it cannot be racist if we only have white people in our jails. So,
I think you're pleading guilty to something. When you like racist has such a pejorative meaning. It means discriminating unfairly on the basis of race. Well, I would say the criminal justice system, at least in Canada, tries to bend over backwards to understand where blacks have been victims of racism and colonialism and slavery. Maybe they should get a break. In fact, that's actually a case right now before the Canadian courts that they are, Native Indians already get what we call the Native discount. They get a lesser sentence because of colonialism, blah, 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 blah.
Absolutely. And let me make a point. that underscores the fact that our justice system is racist, because we bend over backwards to not make it equal, to make it disparate based upon race. Like, take for example, I thought if I were going to be a judge, and I'd run for judge, and for some reason the people didn't want me, but I thought if I were a criminal judge, and I had to mete out sentences, I would try to do my best to be racially neutral, but I would naturally think that I would sentence, my natural sentiment would be to sentence the white person more than the black person or the Hispanic person, because I would hold them to a higher standard because I think they're better than that. And the black or the Hispanic would go, well, yeah, you know, that's your nature. So I wouldn't be so strict with them. And that is a racist concept. Now, it's different than what Bernie Sanders says. Bernie Sanders says it's taking the exact opposite. They're in jail because we're racist. And of course, that doesn't make sense because white people do generally act like the Canadian government is doing, bending over backward, making their criminal justice system racist by not sentencing the Indians to the same level of justice that the white man.
I think that's a good point. You're flipping the accusation on its head, and that is the reality. Our systems bend over backwards.
But absolutely, like for example, when you have a white person who comes up for trial to be charged before his peers on a racial related matter, a hate crime, whatever it is, the two groups that you don't want to have on your jury are white people, because they're going to rule against you, they're going to hold you to a higher standard, and black women, because they're going to try to punish you. So if I were going to be put, I'd pack the jury with black men, you know, because they'd be a little more understanding. If it was a white guy who committed a race crime, a hate crime. So I don't know. But it is. We can't.
Or Oriental men who are so fed up with their black misbehavior, they're probably on your side.
No, they'll follow the crowd. The crowd right now is beat up on the white man, so now they follow the crowd. You put on your jury a bunch of crackhead black men, and they're more likely to let you off. But whatever. But the point is that nothing is going to work. Bernie Sanders, I believe, is on the right track when he brings up that race factor. He doesn't know the answer. He just pointed out the factor. But that's how science develops things. Somebody sees an issue, and then someone smarter comes along and finds a solution. But okay, the next one is to have, I guess he's going to have a whole bunch of people police their communities, but they're going to do it with, you know, with super soapers, not guns. So what do you guys think about that?
My thought is, again, he's just pandering to the black vote. I don't think he intends to implement any of these things, even if he could possibly get elected. I think we all know Bernie Sanders will never be president of the United States.
I want to talk about that later on after we exhaust these three components. But I think the concept of having the community police themselves is a good one. California just has now passing a law to do away with forced posses. Before, you know, California was part of the old West. And the policeman could say, when they're arresting somebody, they could tell somebody, hey, you have to come in and assist me. And that's the old posse law. The sheriff, you know, Gary Cooper, could put a badge on all of his little, people and make them go out and hop on their horses and go round up the bad guys. And that's still law until they're just now changing it. And so what Bernie Sanders wants to do is, instead of doing away with the posse law, he wants to increase it but take away their guns. I think there's something there to it. What would happen if we took the police out of our communities and say, okay, we're not going to go in and deal with any domestic violence situation? Because I believe, if you look at the statistics, the most dangerous time that a policeman has is when he goes and tries to interfere with the domestic violence. Stop that. That's where he gets shot the most. So what if we say, okay, fine, communities, police yourselves. We're not going to answer any calls regarding domestic violence. I think that might be a good solution. Of course, that's not what Bernie Sanders is contemplating, but I think that might not be bad.
Yeah, it needs to be tweaked. Now, I live in a no-go zone. The police do not come into my neighborhood. The reason is nobody commits crimes. We don't break into houses. We don't shoot each other.
Yeah.
So the police sit out on the highway down the block and give people speeding tickets. So when people behave themselves, why do we need authority? You know, just make sure the guidelines are enforced. True in black neighborhoods. What will happen if, perchance, the Sander plan that we're enacting, and it could possibly be somewhere down the road, you unleash the worst of the worst into the black community, and it becomes what I term a self-cleaning oven. They kill each other. So to me, that is ultimate racism. And these guys know this, by the way. The cornerstone of Marxist revolution is to destabilize. They call it their struggle. They have another term for it. They want to destabilize society, culture. Best way to do that, and incidentally, 20%, statistically, 20% of prison inmates are clinical psychopaths, compared to about 1% of the general population. And you can actually detect psychopathy with a brain scan, because components of the brain are just different. So they're turning loose, the idea is to turn loose psychopaths, people who are incapable of behaving themselves. They just can't help it. It's
I know, but see, I've
pathological.
I've never considered myself to embrace the Marxist doctrine, but I am so dissatisfied with the way all Western countries are going. I see that destabilized. I think America has a terrible influence on the entire world, and I'm thinking whatever destabilizes this government isn't a bad thing. And so, you know, if you did release all of these psychopaths, like you say, out in the community, that would speed up, I think, a revolutionary change that we have to have in order to make things work again.
Why is there so little violence crime in Iceland? The answer's obvious, you know, but...
it's an almost, you know, homogeneous population.
It's effectively an ethno state. Not literally, but effectively.
But that won't last forever. I mean, they're trying to destroy them as well. But then even the Icelanders, they don't have kids anymore. They abort everything. In fact, Duterte from the Philippines was making fun of Iceland. They said, "What's wrong with you women? You're not having any kids. You're aborting all your kids." And I think there's a lot of change that we need to bring onto our Western people. But let's go to the very last component. He says we need to do away with the death penalty. And that's where I come down very much different than what Bernie Sanders does. I think we should expand the death penalty in spades. I think that we have too many people in this world, too many bad people, and we don't need that. How many percent did you say are psychopaths in the prison?
20%.
We don't need those psychopaths. We don't need all these homeless people on the street.
You can't just kill them, can you? I mean, you could,
okay.
But that would
all
not
right.
be more.
This would be in England. In England, they made stealing a dog a misdemeanor. Why? Because it used to be that if you stole a dog, it was punishable by death because it was a felony. And so they thought, well, stealing a dog isn't worth dying for, you know? And that was the first step towards mamby-pambiness. I think we need to take the Bernard Shaw approach. All these people, you let them determine whether or not they're a benefit to society, and if they are not a benefit to society, then you decide what to deal with them. And maybe it is taking a little bit too extreme, saying to terminate their lives, to put in capital punishment. But we have to do something. We cannot allow the metastasization of our communities by all of these worthless people. So maybe, you know, the solution might be generational. What you do is that if someone wants to get public assistance, you got to be sterilized. And maybe in a generation or two, they'll do away with a lot of problems. But we just It's unworkable. The situation we have now is unworkable. And I think that the approach saying we've got to do away with the death penalty is an absolute bad approach. I think we need to expand the death penalty, maybe not to where our English ancestors did, saying, well, you steal a dog and you get cacked. But you got to do something, I think.
Well, you know, you're echoing a great idea that was circulated in the early 70s by William Shockley, the man of the transistor. And he ruined his career when he made the observation that the ruination of the Negroes was the welfare system, which rewarded them for the more children they had. And he recommended a system whereby before you could accept welfare, you would have to agree to be sterilized. I believe that was already, or actually there'd be even incentives. He was recommending giving about a $20,000 incentive to any black female on welfare who agreed to sterilization. And $20,000 in 1970 would be, you know, like probably $100,000 today. But long range for society, both in terms of the cost of the illegitimate children and the lifetime of welfare and crime and all the rest of it, and the fact that more and more, you know, very low IQ people are being born, it was a great idea. Of course, that didn't jive with the spirit of the times, and you know, basically his reputation was ruined. But he was a great man, and he was having a very similar idea.
When I was at Harvard Law School, they scheduled to have William Shockley come speak, and there was the biggest brouhaha, and they canceled. They wouldn't let him come, even back then. And the other big issue at that time was Nestle. It was making baby formula and selling it into the black communities, and what they were in the black rural areas. And what the mothers would do, they would water it down so much that the babies weren't getting enough nutrition, and they're really malnourished. So who did the Harvard student body blame? They blamed Nestle for selling baby formula in the African countries. And so, you know, my approach was a little bit different then, but I thought, okay, I don't like this, what's going on here. So I remember going into the Harvard store and in front of everybody, picking up all of the boxes of Hershey chocolates and buy them all at one time. I bought a box of Hershey chocolates. And I put it on there, and they were boycotting it, their own sides. Boycotting, I was coming out with these two big boxes of Hershey chocolates. And I can never got so sick of Hershey's. Not that my classmates wouldn't eat them. I did that. It was kind of like, and I've changed. I don't like that approach. Like, I know that in one of these, I think it was at Princeton, they built a shanty town to have solidarity with these, with the South Africans. And so they built a shanty town, and they're living out in just the absolute squalor like the Africans did. And so the Princeton Republican Party, right next door, set up a croquet tournament. And they had a croquet tournament, and they had glasses of wine. They were the ascots, and they're sitting there playing croquet and drinking wine next to the shanty. So, you know, that was what the young kids were doing when I was in college.
Gary, I'm looking at this as almost, you know, old times, but the inability to understand causality is scary. I mean, so because Negro mothers watered down the Nestle milk, it's Nestle's fault. No, it's them. Or, you know, because Tishon goes out and blasts a few people in a bar, we've got to have gun control. No, we've got to have people control. Or at least Tishon control.
Let me ask you guys a question. Hypothetical to the end, but what would the world be like if there were only white people? What if tomorrow there was some bacterial virus that just overnight, black death plague wiped out everybody who is not white? What would the world be like 5-10 years from now?
Well, I think that the overarching consideration would be, what would the world be like if we had eugenics? And if we had only white people, that would not be enough. There's a lot of bad white people. But if we had that hand in hand with eugenics, where the best people reproduced and the worst people did not reproduce at all, and it would be on a sliding scale where, you know, the better you are, the with all of the best qualities, you'd reproduce the most. And that eugenics would not do away with all of the non-whites, but it would do away with a lot of the non-whites and a lot of the whites, and the world would be a whole lot better. Eventually, though, there still would be conflict because of the racial divide. If you had only one racial group of people and you instituted a policy of eugenics, initially it might be heavy-handed and people that living under that system would not like it so much, but for the long-range goal, you'd have a much better population. You'd have a great environment. There wouldn't be so many people, and the little animals and the flora and the fauna, they'd have a place to prance around and grow and expand. We could really make it nice. And you wouldn't have all of these oppressive laws. If you wanted to go out and borrow money from a bank, it would be like in the old days where you shake hands with the bank president, you take the money and you go home. And there would not be all these regulations. It would really be, now this is going to tax my biblical knowledge, it would be like the city of Enoch. Is that right, Ken?
I have no idea.
You know what the city of Enoch is? You were a preacher. The city of Enoch, I think everybody was so righteous that they went up to heaven.
Well, Enoch was translated to heaven.
But his whole city was, I believe.
Okay, I just now Googled it, so I'll have to study on it. But I would argue while you're looking that up, Bill.
Yeah.
What is the antinomian?
That looks like it's a Mormon belief. That's why you don't know it. Okay, there you go. I apologize. Go on.
I would argue that if you could... what is the antonym of eugenics? The opposite of eugenics is...
Dysgenics. Anyway, the opposite of eugenics is America.
Well, I would argue that we are in the process. We're in a eugenical process. I invented an adjective.
We are. It is.
So it is eugenics, but it's just backwards. They're doing the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Of what we would like to see happen. But I'm not sure that I want to see all non-white people disappear, but...
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I do see a tremendous value in encouraging high IQ, and not just intelligence, but also behavior, because it's genetic. Black people, encouraging them to make more babies. But we're doing just the opposite. We're actually paying low IQ women... Black women to make as many babies as they can. And by the way, I throw this in very quickly. For those who still watch television, watch the commercials, and notice it's always a white man with a white woman. When very seldom they pair a white man with a black female mate, the black female is always fat and frumpy. Why are they doing that? I think they're trying to create a new norm in our minds.
Well,
part of this genetics.
I think the concept of racism has gotten so out of hand that it's not a direct, conscious endeavor to destroy the white race. What it is, it's a direct, conscious endeavor to not be called racist. And if you only have a white family with white children, they are afraid that they'll be accused of, you know, if you're having potato chips where a white family is enjoying it, they'll be considered to be racist and they'll be attacked. So I think we become so hypersensitive about the term racist that they promote that, not to destroy the white race, but to avoid any possibility. It was just like who's that guy that did Star Wars? His name was, he was a Scottish name. What's that guy that did Star Wars?
Stanley Kubrick?
No. Oh, his name is... He's a big, big, very successful guy. Well, he married a black woman and through in vitro fertilization had a black child. And it's just sick because he was accused of being racist by having Jar Jar Binks appear to be you know, a slave type guy, Lucas, George Lucas. And so what did he do in response? He went out and married a black woman and had black kids. And so it's just ridiculous. And that's the type of person that we need to do the opposite of what Bernie Sanders wants.
There are some people of other races who get it, too. The first prime minister of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, worried about the fact that so many intelligent women were not having children and were going in for executive or high level jobs, and he built in an incentive plan to allow them to stay home and still get a good income, because basically he felt that their genes were important. This pattern of quite intelligent women having no children or only one, and very unintelligent women having large numbers of children, he could see that that was not the way for Singapore to go. And Singapore, as you well know, being an old Asia hand, is a very highly successful experiment.
By the way, did you know that if you have four or more children in Hungary, you pay no income taxes for life? So if you want to be a career woman and never pay income taxes before you start your career.
Did you know that in America, if you're black and you have four or more children, you pay no income tax either? In fact, you get money. we've outdone them. Okay, in any event, now I want to jump over all of this. I want to move away from the three components of Bernie Sanders to ask you the question that was posed by Ken just a while ago, when he said, well, Bernie Sanders is never going to be president. Okay, so who's going to be the Democratic nominee?
I would guess Joe Biden. Okay, it's not an answer to your question, but keep your eye on Donald Trump Jr. 2024.
Okay. What do you think, Canadian?
Well, all I know is what I get from my daily swill of poison on CNN. But I can't believe that Biden will get it. Yes, the polls suggest he's way ahead among the other Democratic front runners, but he looks old, he looks creepy. I don't think he's got it. But maybe they will make him their champion, and I think Donald Trump will eat him for lunch.
Okay, when they first came out, before they had the first debate, the first person to really explode on the scene was that mayor from Indianapolis.
Buttigieg,
or whatever it is.
He's now from Indianapolis.
Okay, we
do not want him.
Okay. But I'm saying that when he burst on the scene, a lot of the people that I was talking to saying, oh, it's going to be Buttigieg is going to get it. And now he's kind of fizzled. And, of course, Joe Biden has always been the front runner. Bernie Sanders has always been tagging him right behind. But the latest polls are saying that the person hard to beat is Elizabeth Warren. And I think that Elizabeth Warren is way more wacky than any of these others. But I think, as it stands today, I think she's got the momentum, and so she might be the candidate.
I think Biden is the Bob Dole of the Democrats. Just a throwaway candidate. We're not going to win. Let's put him out there. Liz Warren can come along later.
We'll see, but there was just on the radio when I was coming back to the show, they made an announcement that Donald Trump's approval rating is 37%, and he loses to everybody that's running against him. You know, so we'll see what happens. All right. In any event, let's go to Sinead O'Connor. I'm not sure I'm spelling that right.
Sinead O'Connor.
Okay. How do you pronounce it?
Skinhead O'Connor.
Skinhead O'Connor. Okay. So tell me what the story is about her and what's going on.
Well, Sinead O'Connor, most people know that she has this public relations practice where she says and does outrageous things to draw attention to herself. However, according to the story, let me scroll down here, This is sourced from Breitbart.com. Irish musician Sinead O'Connor has backtracked and apologized for her comments last year in which she called white people and non-Muslims disgusting. Here is what she said on Twitter after she said she would not want to spend time with white people. I'm terribly sorry. What I'm about to say is something so racist, I never thought my soul could ever feel it. But truly, I never want to spend time with white people again, if that's what non-Muslims are called.
Okay. Now, I think that I try to look for the good in everybody. And
good luck.
There's a lot of good that you can say about her. She has 4 children. She has criticized Miley Cyrus. Miley Cyrus is doing all those gross things. She criticized Miley Cyrus. Now, she's gone off on the deep end by becoming a Muslim. But there's a lot of white people really need to wake up and realize there's a lot of bad people out there. I mean, you go down the street, you see a white person, there's tattoos all up and down their arms, and they're fat, and there's a lot of things that are bad things about them. So they're, in a sense, that is positive, what she says. Maybe it'll help wake white people up. The fact that she has embraced the Muslim religion, if you try to find, well, maybe she's so disgusted with the Miley Cyruses of the world, she's looking for a religion where there's more wholesomeness. But then, okay, I think she's been a serial wife, so I don't know that she's the type of person that's been wholesome. But I remember that she would criticize the Pope, and when she criticized the Pope, she criticized the Pope for things that I could understand her criticizing for. So although my approach would be, let's make the white people the best people we can, her approach is, well, I don't want to deal with white people because they're bad. I want to hang out with all the Muslims. So I think that's wacko. However, one thing I need to mention is that she first gained notoriety by doing a remake or a cover of a Prince song that just made her hugely successful. And I did the legal work to take Prince to Japan one time. And he was just wacky. He had all these hangers-on. I had in my attorney trust account $1 million of funds to pay him, and I was supposed to give it to all of these Prince supporters, and I'd get all these bank account numbers from them, and they wouldn't be real bank accounts because they were so under the table. They didn't have bank accounts, and they didn't want to let Prince know that they didn't have bank accounts. So they made up all these bank accounts and gave it to Prince, and Prince gave it to me, and I tried to pay out all this money was rejected. It caused a devil of a time straightening out my attorney's trust account because all these checks were coming back, couldn't find the funds. So the fact I have Prince is really dear to my heart because it generates so many legal fees. I think, yeah, that's a good thing. She did a cover of a Prince song.
Well, I would take nothing that she says seriously. I think she's all about self-promotion. I was watching, I'll say this very quickly, but I was watching a documentary interviewing Donny Osmond. You have an affinity with the Osmonds because of their Mormon background. And he has the squeaky clean image. But the point is, he was saying when they were in a rut, they were having serious financial problems. His promoter suggested that they stage a drug bust at a major airport, international airport, just to get attention and pump some life into his career. And he said he actually considered it because they were in that dire of a strait. So I think this is what Sinead O'Connor is doing. Okay, I doubt she believes any of this. I think she's just self-promoting.
Well, I don't know. I think you can say that about Lady Gaga and Madonna. But I remember Sinead O'Connor coming in every time she's come in, and I think she is truly, in the bottom of her heart, wacky. I don't believe it's a made-up belief like Madonna or Lady Gaga. I think that's her. I think she's part of that 20% that you say is afflicted in the prison. But I don't know. I do. I think there's a lot of good in Sinead O'Connor. It's just that when she attacks white people for the wrong reasons, and we got to call her to task. Okay. Well, let's move on. Let's take the next one. Second generation migrants are more likely to commit crimes than their parents. This surprises me. Tell us what that story is and then let's analyze it.
Well, this story is actually out of Norway. They did some research. And here's what I posted on my website. Prepare yourself for some statistics. The children of Islamic invaders are more likely to commit crimes than their parents. The Norway study revealed that Somali males ages 15 through 35 who were born in Norway are 4.6 times more likely to commit violent crimes compared to first generation Somali immigrants, put that in quotes. Second generation Iraqis are 4 times more likely to commit violent crimes, Moroccans 3.2 times more likely, and Turks 2.8 times more likely, and Pakistanis 2.4 times more likely. And it goes on with more statistics. I threw in something there about Somalis having an average IQ of 68, which is 2 points below the threshold for retardation. So the nation of Somali is literally retarded.
I've noticed a similar pattern in Canada. We've got a big problem with Somalis right after the Civil War broke out. Into the Black Hawk Down, and our special forces were withdrawn because they beat up and killed one or two Somalis trying to get into their camps. It was just a complete disaster, but we brought in tens of thousands of these people, and it's not worked out well. I think the first generation may be relatively quiet because they're still maybe worried about maybe perhaps being deported, but their children are indulged with multiculturalism, which tells them their culture is as good as anybody else's, maybe better, so they're not urged to get on the agenda. They're feeling pretty cocky because it's very difficult to deport them. They're probably born here, so there are problems. And then they have the natural propensity to violence, low IQ, that doesn't help. And among the Somalis, a very high use of something called khat, which is not something you lie on. It's khat. It's a leaf, and they chew it. And it has bad effects on mood. And it first makes you just, you can take on the world. It's, as I understand, it's like a cocaine rush. You know, that makes him very aggressive. You put a gun in the hand of someone like that, and he's really aggressive, and then they crash. And then that makes them dangerous, too. It's a bad scene. I can see why sociologically that might indeed be the case.
Well, I think that this study underscores what I think I've talked about this in previous broadcast. Eric Hoffer's The Ordeal of Change. Now, Eric Hoffer was the longshoreman philosopher who spent his whole life working as a longshoreman, working picking lettuce in California, and in his free time he'd be writing books. And he wrote The True Believer, which was very successful, and he wrote another book, was called The Ordeal of Change. And he says that only the disaffected, the dissatisfied, the people immigrate. You know, if you're happy and pleased with where you are, you stay there. But if you are looking for something better, then you will immigrate. And then when you come and you're a first generation, you're overwhelmed with the new society. It's better than what you left, and that you embrace it. You're thankful for what you have, and you concentrate on adjusting. Then the next generation, they're the ones that feel self-entitled. They look around, they see the native, you know, in this situation, the native Norwegians, the beautiful blonde-haired, blue-eyed children that are successful and hardworking, and then they are more likely to feel self-entitled and then act out their own, I guess, the problems that back in their own country. And so, you know, and so it's only the white people that would embrace this type of great displacement because of this attitude. We think, oh, we can raise everybody up by their bootstraps. You know, if the white people go into Africa or India, you know, we're looked upon as colonists, and they rise up and they kick us out, every single one of us, and we all leave because, oh, we shouldn't be there. But then when they colonize our country, we just embrace them, and if someone rises up and say, hey, this is not right, then they pound us down with terms of racism. So we really got to wake up our people.
But the same Africans are inviting the Chinese.
Yeah, they're inviting the Chinese for now, and then they're gonna say, well, we, you know, we're oppressed by the Chinese, leave, and the Chinese are gonna say, sorry, we're here to stay.
My theory is, that's a little bit off topic, but my theory is there is a common denominator between the African elite, the tiny number of sub-Saharan Africans who have IQs above 140, and the Chinese, and that is they are all communists. Whereas Europeans, we tend to be individualists, we have free markets, we don't like government control. China is just the opposite. So I think there is really a perfect fit from their perspective, not ours. Perfect fit for the Chinese to basically turn sub-Saharan Africa into slave countries. And I think they're doing it.
Southwest Africa, or they call it Namibia now, a couple years ago, I saw my guide was pointing to a lot of red Chinese building and investment. And I said, well, what do the Negroes think of that? Well, they said at first that they welcomed them because, well, they weren't white, so that's great. But now, well, they find that they're not treated well at all. That they long actually for the presence of the white people, because they were, many of them, or most of them, were Christian and felt obligated to be fair and try to be kind and all that. Whereas the Chinese are under no such moral obligation, and they treat the black either brutally and dismissively, or else just work around them. In fact, in some of the farms they've opened up in Kenya, they bring in Chinese labor. They find the blacks, they'd rather work with their own people, and they're too lazy.
They want to be around white people because white people are chumps. You know,
yeah.
And that's where we've been for too long, you know. All right, we have time enough for one more discussion.
Before you dig into the next discussion, let me say a couple things very quickly. That we had a fairly good group in the chat room tonight, 20-some people, which is a little bit higher than normal. And also, I want to say to James Edwards, where are you? We missed you tonight, so we'll try to catch him next month. Okay, sorry for the interruption. Go ahead.
Oh, by the way, I did attend a function where I spoke, and people came up to me afterwards and said, hey, I watched your blog, I watched the you on TV, I watched your Ethnostate, and I forwarded it to other people.
Cool.
So I felt like a celebrity. I felt like one of the Kardashians. So in any event, let's talk about the last one. The University of Alabama official quits because he didn't like the flag.
Okay, this is a guy by the name of Jamie R. Riley. My understanding is he is a PhD now. I don't feel sorry for this guy, because if you're black and you have an earned PhD, whether you deserve it or not, quite frankly, you can get hired just about anywhere doing anything. But the story is this. Breitbart.com did some digging into this guy's background, and they discovered that he said something. This is kind of like the Sinead O'Connor post. He said something on Twitter, excuse me just a second, that they found offensive. He said the American flag represents a systemic history of racism for my people. Police are part of that system. It is hard to see the correlation. Is it that hard to see the correlation? Question mark. So he resigned because of the controversy caused because he played the race card. A little bit. Normally it's the other way around. It's a white guy that has to resign because he's a quote racist unquote. This time it's a black guy that felt the pressure to bail out. Now, before we go on, did a little bit of research and I discovered this. According to payscale.com, the average pay for a dean of students at a university is just under $100,000 a year. This is University of Alabama, my guess is. He's probably $120,000, I don't know. And according to globalgrowing.org, the average annual income in sub-Saharan Africa, $2,041. So, when I see that disparity between income of what he would have had he not come to America, vicariously through his ancestors, obviously, this guy would probably be living with a bone in his nose, and that would be his prized possession. Where do these guys get this idea that America